Psalm 115, verse 3 reads, "But our God is in the heavens. He hath done whatsoever He hath pleased." As I researched this topic, this very fiercely debated subject, I noticed that there was a multitude of controversies that had been forgotten. And the old argument is, what about all these Greek manuscripts that don't have the verse? And today the argument continues. And the reason I begin with that verse is that the Lord knows the end from the beginning. Everything that He has done is happening according to His perfect plan and purpose. If He has ordained that there would be 8 Greek manuscripts, 5 of them having the verse in the margin and 3 in the text, and if there would be no more, or if there will be 20 more or 200 more, it's all planned. And who are we to say that we have to have 20 or 200 manuscripts? But so what you may ask, what's my strategy in defending the verse? I think of an attack and a soldier having his shield, and he guards against the attacks. But then when we initially think that the attacks are stones and sharp spears, then I look at the other side of the shield, and I notice that there's pebbles. And so they have cast doubt upon the verse, and my reaction is to cast doubt upon their accusations. And it's quite incredible the quantity of contradictions within their accusations. Now I'll have quite a bit of material, and I'll rush through as quickly as I can. I would
think I'll put Michael with a portable mic here so that he can testing 1, 2. Is this on further, faster? We probably need another switch back there for another outlet. Is Pastor Hollywood here? Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. That way you can roam and we can still hear you, see.
All right.
I hope we can still hear you. Huh? Uh-huh. As soon as he gets here, you'll be able to be heard even way over here. All right, play.
And I also noticed that many of these critics have no interest in theology, no interest in evangelism, no concern about lost souls. They just want to be concerned with manuscripts, and Christians are not like that. They do care about people, and they do want to be obedient to these spiritual duties. But also in the area of theology, I've had to pause and wonder how Satan works. What is his strategy? He attacks the person of Christ. And we think of the inscripturated word, the scriptures, and the incarnate word, the person of Jesus Christ. And Satan attacks both of them with his full fury. But what agents does he use to attack the divinity of Christ? He uses ancient cults, and Arianism, Sabellianism, and then the modern cults, which I don't have to name. And to attack the scriptures, his favorite agent is Roman Catholicism. The term I prefer is popery. I take the old-fashioned Baptist view that the Pope is Antichrist. And we'll see how popery is involved in this. Now, let me begin. I mention that because of the factor of the Vulgate. History has shown that our Baptist forefathers have despised the Vulgate. We know that the Presbyterians and Lutherans have also done likewise. But that's the factor. And so Satan attacks the person and work of Christ, the written word and his person. But there's one thing that's remarkable in this attack, that popery teaches within their doctrine the doctrine of the Trinity. And as best as I can see, as far as I'm aware, there's no contradiction. In fact, Dr. George Boole had written an essay on the Trinity, and the Catholic scholar Boole said, "You have done such a
excellent job in defending the Trinity. Why don't you come over to Rome and do an essay on the corruption of the papacy? But let me get to work and I've selected these passages, and I'll have to go through them rapidly, beginning on page 8. There's much confusion over the term Latin Vulgate. There's at least 5 definitions. It's either referred to as a Latin version completed by Jerome himself in AD 384, or a Latin manuscript of Jerome's version, or the predominance of these manuscripts, which occurred but not after the 9th century, or it's referred to Codex Amiantinus, said to be the best manuscript of Latin Vulgate, or it's the latest edition of the printed Vulgate, such as the Stuttgart 1 or Stuttgart 2. And there's a whole, I listed a whole series of Vulgates, and this is significant because the NKJV people say we go by the Septuagint and the Vulgate, and then when I write to them which Vulgate, they don't answer. So that's significant. 20. I also want to say I appreciate Dr. Hills very much, but there's a problem with the historiography. I take the Baptist view of history, and I don't think that the received text began with the Reformation, but I believe, as Bergen did, that the received text has been a dominant view all throughout the centuries. Now, I won't say more on that, but it's a significant part of my paper, and I just wanted to touch on that. Postillion in 380, I've listed a number of quotes of the verse known as Kama Yohanan. Postillion has the quote, and the last verses in Latin are Et haec tria unum sunt in Christo Jesu. Notice that in the last three words are in Christo Jesu. Now our opponents, we have to be aware of this, are going to say, look, there's an addition, in Christo Jesu. And the argument is involved in that. It's an addition, and so the argument involves why is it there, and some have suggested that Priscillian inserted it, and some scholars have even gone further and said that David inserted the entire verse. And I, when I first saw that argument, I didn't know how to answer that. But when you, and I encourage you all to read my paper. But in 1909, a French scholar named Babut, B-A-B-U-T, answered that quite effectively. There's also that prologue of Jerome, and many of you are perhaps have known about that. I found a quotation from Cardinal William Sulitz from a German work, and translated a portion of here. He says, Erasmus said that Jerome merely expresses the assumption that this passage of several passages is forged. Judge for yourself whether these words in this Latin express only an assumption. The sentence is so clear that I regard it superficial to write more about it. Jerome said that irresponsible translators left out this testimony. He said this in order that it may be understood that formerly it occurred in the Greek codices. We may conclude that in his time the Greek books were not yet tempered with at this passage. And there's much more in there. I'm just touching on that. Codex Amiantinus is a famous manuscript, Scrivener, dated about 541. However, there's a debate. Schaff has made the remark that's the oldest and best manuscript. But Kenyon says it must have been written quite early in the 8th century. The point I wanted to make there is that it does not have verse 1 John 5, 7, 8. It does not have Acts 8, 37, Acts 9, 5, and 6, 15, 34, 18, 4, etc. It does not have these verses, but the later Vulgates do. And so the question I ask them, if these verses came into the later Vulgate and they weren't in the best, which is Codex Amiantinus, where did they come from? All right, now I have a Codex Montfortianus. That's dated 13th century. it would probably take too much time to set up these charts. I'm kind of hesitating whether I should do this or not. 12:50.
Yeah,
that's good. Now, on this one, the reading is given here according to the facsimile provided by Adam Clark. All right. Scribner has said this codex is the same as Britannicus. Now, the question is, what is the reading of Britannicus? Well, I don't know. Nobody has ever seen it. But these opponents are saying these manuscripts are identical. This one is available. It's in England, and there now. But what it, there's a long discussion. But what it comes to is all these words right here are missing in this manuscript, and you can see that. But there's a passage in Erasmus that shows it has these words, and so I'm asking how could this manuscript be the same as that? There's some other differences. There's article Hoy Matruntes, and this doesn't have that article. So, from other essays, I've noted that there are these differences. There's an interesting Latin manuscript called Codex Perpignanus, dated to the 13th century. You can find that in Nestle. But what was quite interesting, that was discovered in 1895, and that also has an edition in Cristoriosi that doesn't belong there. However, in an article of 1911, I found that this manuscript, its orthographical forms, that is, its spelling, proved that P was copied from a manuscript not later than the 6th century before the words began to be divided. Now, this manuscript contains Acts 8:37, Acts 9, 5, and 6, verse 10, 6, 10, 21, 15, 24, which are disputed verses, which the majority text has omitted. But I think it's quite fascinating to know about that. There's that Augsburger manuscript in the city of Augsburg. That's the oldest complete German New Testament. I've been wondering about that for quite a long time. I borrowed my confession, and it does have that. That reading is unique. I'm assuming you all know the verse, for there are three in him, for there are three that bear witness, the Father, the Word, and the Holy Spirit. And then when it says the Word, and some have the Son, and this manuscript has both with the Word in German or between it, so it has the Son or the Word. It's quite unique. Then Codex Gregory 629 is another manuscript, I would have to urge you to read that. I'll have to skip over this one. This is where I have found made a calculation as to what Britannicus might have said, because in a work by Dr. Dobbin, he compared the reading for what he thought was Britannicus as provided in a work by Erasmus, and he was honest enough to admit that it agrees with the Montfort, quote, except in the omission of the word Hagion, which is holy, and of the article Hoy before Marcheruntes. And how does he explain that? Because he said that they were the same, Montfort, with the Britannicus. He claims they are clearly typographical errors because they are not wanting in this third edition of the Greek Testament. Now, there's an author named Forster, Charles Forster, and he said Bishop Marsh labors hard to identify the Britannicus used by Erasmus with the Codex Montfort. But it's from Forster, who shows that from comparing what Erasmus says and from what the Codex Montfort says, that they just can't possibly be the same. 52. Of interest is when Paulus von Basel sent two manuscripts from Corax B to Erasmus. That happened in June of 1521, and there were two passages. One, 1 John 4, verses 1 through 3, and also 1 John 5, verses 7 through 11. Erasmus looked at that for a number of reasons, including that passage, and then he rejected it. Martin Luther is the next event. His first Bible, his September Testament, appeared in 1522. Luther left it out. And in as of 1527, 5 years later, we find some comments that Luther made that are quite fascinating. 1524, Luther's, we know his famous opponents were Erasmus and Eck, but really, according to Kenneth Strand, his most vicious opponent was Jerome Emser. He had written a book against Luther's translation, and in a work by Johann M. Goetze, he said, "So Luther stood firm as a pillar, and he was so much less moved to take up this version of his translation. That is, the screaming was more despised and more bitter, which the papists and especially Emser had for that reason made against him. These were precisely the reasons which determined the attitude of Bugenhagen." But I mention that because these recent articles did not mention that, and that might be a clue as to why Luther, another additional clue as to why Luther left it out. Now, here's what Luther said according to Weimar Ausgabe. "There are three who give testimony. Why is this locus not translated in the German translation?" He replied, "I and others believe that it is sort of added, that it is added by some ignoramus. We do not want, however, to translate it because of the word testimony, because in heaven there will be no need for a testimony. As it is written, we will see God face to face. There the Trinity will declare himself." In an article of 1985, Fawcett quoted this from Luther's graduate student, George Ruhr. And as I read this, I was quite disappointed at the lack of reverence that Luther had. He says, "For there are three. This locus in Greek causes do not have it. It seems that it was inserted ineptly by the ignorance of ancient theologians against Arius. If one looks at the analogy of faith, where God is seen, there is no need for a testimony. But here it's added, here we have it in the Word, and we do not want to have it any other way, since there is no testimony in heaven and no faith, which are of this type. Therefore, we leave out this text. Also, the subsequent text ridicules this verse, and I can make fun of it easily because there is no more in that locus for the Trinity." 1529. I found this quite interesting. Jakob Kautz. I've asked, who is Jakob Kautz in various studies? He's interesting in that he published the first complete German Bible based on the original text. Now, you won't get that from Protestant, when I say the term Protestant, you won't find that in Lutheran or Presbyterian articles. Kautz, according to the Midnight Encyclopedia, Kautz and Rogan, his friend, drew up a statement of the faith. They knew only adult baptism. Infant baptism was not in accord with Christ's command. That's fascinating to me. 1531. Full shower. When I was in Tübingen, my instructor assigned me to work on the German-Swiss Bible, and I had not even heard about such a thing. I just was aware of the German Bible of Luther. But then it turns out that in Zurich, Switzerland, they had a different Bible. It's not the same as High German, but it's in Schweizerdeutsch. And so I looked at that, and to my surprise, I just did not expect the verses there. And the date, 1531, is the date of the complete Bible, and later on I'll talk about the significance of that. 1533 Sepulveda. That's interesting. Let's see now. Sepulveda was a Spanish humanist and historian who was at Rome about 1533. David says, "On November 1st, he wrote to Erasmus that in his edition of the New Testament, he had found a diversity correct text. Kenyon says, of course, that I cannot say. A few readings from it were supplied to Erasmus by his correspondent, Sepulveda, but too late for use in his editions. In his claim, Kenyon made two serious errors. It was not too late because Erasmus' fifth edition appeared in 1535, nor was it merely a few readings when this letter of Sepulveda furnished Erasmus with 365 readings as a convincing argument in support of his statements that Codex Vaticanus is, quote, a weighty proof of excellence with a Latin version against the common received text. Now, I've read recently a claim, recently of last year, that if Erasmus had access to UBS 3 or Nestle, he would have used it. But that's ridiculous because of what Sepulveda tried to do. He took 365 readings from Vaticanus and said, look, it's the same as the Vulgate, and trying to persuade Erasmus that he should follow that. Erasmus rejected them all. 1568. Luther's first edition was 1522. His last edition was 1546. And for that period of time, all these editions of Luther in his lifetime did not have the comma. And then within about 23 years, there was a blank space. And that's interesting. 1569 Trimelius, so that's a significant event. If you're well read and somebody asks you, which was the first prince Syriac, then you'd say, well, Trimelius. And then they would say, the comma was not in there. And you can read the account by Scribner and Metzger, but you won't find out something that is another surprise to me. In Trimelius' edition of the Syriac, he left a blank space. And you can find that by reading the account of Ezra Abbott. And so the questions that I have to ask then is, why did Trimelius take time, well, I didn't mention it to you, but he translated it and put it in the margin. Why did he translate it? Why did he put it in the margin? And and why did he leave a blank space for it? Do modern translators do that? No, they certainly don't. 1581. Okay. Now I mentioned the Swiss German Bible that it had. The significance of finding that is I have been misled into thinking that from 1522 to 1546 that all the Germans did not have that verse in the Bible, but since the New Testament portion of this of the Schweizer Deutsch Bible was completed in 1524 or 1525, that means that there was only 2 years of a possible gap, or 2 years or less. All right. So I've underestimated my time, but there's much more, and I'll point out this AMTF number 9. AMTF is the current series put out by the Münster Institute. So they have a list in this volume of 450 manuscripts, and they list each one, and they're saying that all these manuscripts do not have the verse. Now, I can remember back in 1784 that Travis had claimed that 31 manuscripts have the verse. He was an error, and Porson refuted him. And recently in 1980, somebody said that it has, that 20 manuscripts have it. Well, it that kind of zeal we have to be aware of, because we just don't have that quantity of manuscripts that have it. However, we do have abundant Latin manuscripts. There's said to be 8,000 manuscripts, and Metzger has said that there's 10,000. I've looked. Where did he ever get that? I think he just tagged on 2000. Tiller was my professor in Tübingen, and he works at the VLI. That's the Boehmer Institute. That's, you know, where Münster is, where they have the Greek headquarters for the manuscripts in Greek. And then in Boehmer, 8 kilometers south of Tübingen, that's where they have all these old Latin manuscripts. Incidentally, one other thing before I close, I was quite privileged to learn that Tilly had written an article in 1959 to argue against the common views, such as Tish North and Griesbach, who say that Cyprian, one of the oldest church fathers who quotes it, what do Griesbach and Tish North say? Well, they say, oh, he was looking at the 8th verse and he just allegorized it. But Tilly in 1959 argued, no, Cyprian actually had a Latin manuscript in his hands with the verse, and he's going against the crowd, and yet that man is a Hort Westcott man, and yet he's working. I would regard him as the foremost Latin foremost scholar in Latin biblical manuscripts, and he's for the comma. He's in favor of that Cyprian had it, though he doesn't believe in it. He just says, well, his argument is that, yeah, but many of the old Latin manuscripts had an abundance of interpolations. But I said, okay, well, how many people believe and agree with you? He said, I said, well, that was your view 30 years ago. Do you still believe this now? And he said, yeah, Albert, if being a lion. He said, that means yes, but I'm alone. So when it comes to Latin, all the professors, all in all these Germans, they come to him for information on Latin. But when it comes to his view on the comic, they don't want to listen to him.